Tasmania pops in to throw you an absolute pearler, and you should be in an excellent philosophical and scientific state of mind today after a few days' rest, and certainly, if not that, just the chocolate might have done it for you. Ted Lefroy, good morning.
Morning, Rick.
Nice to see you. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
Now, this is a really apt time to have this conversation, really, the question about the idea of Gaia, which is the idea that the Earth is a giant mother, really, sustaining everyone, and whether that's a sort of hippy-dippy belief or hard science. Why is that even worth talking about? Who's brought that up?
Because it's an idea that won't die and go away. So when James Lovelock published his book in 1979, saying that that all the living things on the Earth acted as an organism, a superorganism, to maintain conditions for life, he was jumped on by the biologists, Richard Dawkins in particular. And the idea, it seemed like it was completely untenable, and he was recycling Greek myths. And the argument that the biologist used was the only way that could have come about that we know is through natural selection. But the engine of natural selection is variability or variation. So you pick amongst a whole range of different organisms, you pick the one that is most suited, but there's only one planet. So their argument is, what's the unit of selection? So what they were saying is, if you can't demonstrate the mechanism, then it's not science.
And what was the chap who wrote the book really essentially saying? What were his core arguments?
His core arguments were that it's remarkable that the conditions of the Earth and its atmosphere are maintained in such a suitable state for life, right? So the atmosphere has 78% oxygen, nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and it's remained incredibly stable. If you have a few more percent than 21% oxygen, then you'd have wildfires starting from lightning everywhere. If it was a few percent less, you'd really struggle to strike a match. So how is it that the conditions are maintained perfect for life? And he's a chemist, and he's an ingenious chemist who was made a fellow of the Royal Society for his inventions, devices that could detect pollutants in the atmosphere down to parts per trillion. So he's no slouch, very smart bloke. And he looked at lots of different cycles, the sulfur cycle, the carbon cycle, and he said, there must be some means that this is maintained in the conditions that are perfect for life. Now, he doesn't have the mechanism in mind, but he's putting forward that idea. And because he couldn't describe the mechanism, he was jumped on because the status quo was being threatened in terms of what is an organism.
Why was it threatening to the status quo what he was saying? Why did the notoriously grumpy Richard Dawkins jump down his throat?
Because there would have to be some other means of evolution in the universe other than Darwinian natural selection. Because, for the simple reason that if for a planet to evolve, it's like an organism living alone cannot evolve. A species evolves because there's natural variation, because of mistakes in the transcription of genetic material. So that throws up variability. And then as conditions, the environment changes, the most fit is selected, and that's natural selection.
Okay, so at 20 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart, the Gaia guy is saying that the Earth is one living organism, and then the biologist people are saying it can't possibly be because it's not selected from a range of other possible organisms.
Exactly.
But doesn't then a space person jump in and go, well, there's a whole bazillion planets, this is the one that's got life on it?
Well, the people who jumped in, interestingly, were the geologists and the geographers who bided their time, and by 2001... he was awarded the most prestigious award of the Royal Geographical Society, the Wollaston Medal, because what they recognised is he was onto something. That these cycles are maintained, there are feedbacks that maintain the conditions for life. No one can point to the mechanism yet, but he's raised a fascinating question, and the parallel would be with continental drift. So early last century, a meteorologist of all people, it's a similar parallel story.
He came up with a weatherman.
Yeah. Came up with the idea of continental drift, and he was jumped on by all the geologists. He said, explain, what's the mechanism? There was no mechanism demonstrated for plate tectonics, you know, chunks of the Earth's crust drifting around, until the 1950s or 60s, by which time, he was fine, it was accepted. So, the jury, I would say, is still out. He's raised a fascinating idea. What he's also done is backed off from saying the Earth is an organism or like an organism. What he now says is the combined physical, chemical and biological components of the Earth system regulate the planet so as to maintain it habitable for life.
So it's a self-regulating system, much like our bodies are a self-regulating system.
Yes.
We don't consciously regulate most of our processes.
No, no. And so that idea is still out there. The biologists are still highly sceptical and grumpy because no one's pointed to the mechanism. But in about the early 90s, a new discipline emerged called Earth System Science, which is people who study the interrelation between the geological, chemical and biological cycles on Earth. And there's a growing recognition that there is some degree of connection. And to me, the watershed was a paper published in Nature in 1998 by a fellow called Tim Lenton, who said that you don't that organisms evolving alone can act in concert to create feedbacks, which could provide this sort of stable situation. So he kind of proposed an alternative to the Richard Dawkins idea. So the interesting thing is, it's 36 years since the book came out. It hasn't gone away. It's not accepted uniformly across all disciplines, but it's created a new discipline, and it's posed a lot of fascinating questions.
It's that area, though, where we would have only been seeing all these things as separate because the academic disciplines for them were separate.
Exactly.
People looked at systems as fixed things, not as changing things, and then they were in their own little silos.
That's right. And you see, the interesting thing about Lovelock is not only was he a chemist, but he's remained independent through his whole career. He's been employed as a consultant to NASA and various other people, but he's worked in medicine, marine biology, astronomy. He's glided through the disciplines and strung this together. And exactly as you say, reductionism has been extraordinarily powerful. You know, it's given us computing and the laser and so many different antibiotics.
Reductionism being the idea that
you specialise. The way people are trained, they are trained within one particular discipline,
and that you break the world down to its smallest observable parts.
Exactly. And as a friend of mine says, there's nothing wrong with reductionism except belief that the world is like the method. Clearly the world is not like the method, but the method's been powerful. So what he's done is thrown us a holistic conundrum which has now got people really thinking and working. So, you know, it's not... 15 years ago, I did an interview with ABC Radio in Sydney in the science unit, and I was just trotted out the Richard Dawkins line. It was rubbish. There was no support for it. Nonsense. It's mysticism. But what's interesting is what's happened since.
You've got more mystical.
No.
That's why you're wearing the beads, Ted. It's 7:45 on 936 ABC Hobart. Ted Lefroy is the director for the Centre of Environment at UTAS, and he's looking at the questions, is the idea of Gaia, the Earth being a single sort of self-supporting organism that responds to itself through its own feedback loops, science or a bit of hippy-dippy wonderland? Now, obviously the idea was not put forward by someone who was hippy-dippy in terms of the science part of it. Is it also that maybe we don't have all the ideas that we need to have? So people looked at smaller and smaller building blocks of life, as they were called, and found out that actually when you get to particles, everything's shifting and moving and is more mystical than you thought.
Yeah.
That evolution isn't the only idea. That you've mentioned this word feedback a number of times, that actually feedback is another aspect of sustaining life, that it isn't only driven by evolution.
Exactly. And one of the things, one of the feedback loops that Lovelock described in his book was to do with sulfur. So plankton in the ocean produce a chemical called dimethyl sulfur. And dimethyl sulfur acts to reflect some energy coming to the Earth and also is involved in cloud formation. So if you heat up the oceans and you phytoplankton grows faster, they produce more dimethyl sulfide, it creates more clouds, and so you've got a negative feedback. It's trying to, you know... Trying. See, that's a dangerous word. It's not trying. It just happens that there's... And there are other cycles. Weathering of rocks. It occurs fastest under conditions of higher temperature and rainfall. And a combination of rainfall and carbon dioxide, you get an acid which weathers rocks. And the faster it weathers, the more carbon dioxide it actually ties up and absorbs. So if the Earth is subject to greater warming, weathering is going to happen faster. And so there are positive and negative feedbacks. But what he was saying is they're somehow connected through lots of living organisms. And that is, at the moment, still a form of heresy. But, you know, he's posed a fascinating conundrum.
And it's so hard for us to describe dynamic processes without assigning agency to them, because we're the brains that keep wanting someone to be making that happen, aren't we?
Exactly, and that's the mistake he made. One of the sins he committed in science was to talk about the Gaia as having a goal to maintain conditions fit for life, and that's referred to as teleology. It's looking for causes at a distance, that we are drawn towards something, that there's purpose. And so that Richard Dawkins and others jumped on him for that as well. But what in later editions of the book, he said he was trying his best to convey an idea to a general public. And yes, I did use metaphor and I was teleological. And so he's come back in what he's saying. So he's moved as well. So it's still, you know, it's still a rambling feast, this debate.
Which then also raises the other question, that if the Earth is the self-sustaining organism, then what role our agency plays in it? Are we one of the agents in it, so therefore everything we do fits in with the system?
Yes.
Or are we somehow weirdly separate from it when nothing else is?
Well, that's it. And his most recent book is called The Vanishing Face of Gaia, and he's getting more and more gloomy, because what he's saying is we're now starting to work outside those cycles and that system, and we are in danger of bringing about our own demise. And so he's now realised that lovely cycle he talked about with dimethyl sulfide may not work, because as the oceans heat up, there's less mixing and flux. And so it's not just a direct relationship. Increase the temperature, up goes the growth of the plankton, up goes the amount of dimethyl sulfide. It could actually decrease, which is positive feedback. So it's actually making things hotter. So he's pointed out that we are breaking some of the rules. Now this gets into, now you get into moral philosophy, and that is not science. So, you know, this is a great, ugly, difficult sort of debate and field. But, you know, another thing he said which is interesting is when Copernicus has had his ideas about astronomy, it took a Newton to come along and explain the mechanism. And one of the statements he made in his most recent book is, well, the Newton in Gaia has still yet to arrive. We don't know what the mechanism is, but I'm not worried. I'm convinced it's there. I'm patient that the Newton will come along.
There you are on Ted Lefroy's own road to Damascus 15 years ago, dismissing all the science, now patiently waiting for the mechanism to arrive.
The exposure that my workplace gives me